Good evening, one and all. I'm sitting here on a Sunday night just recording this. I've just edited up the podcast and thoroughly enjoyed it. What can I say? Slightly different one, moving away from the normal movement and breathing people, but actually talking to someone who knows an awful lot about it. And the subject we went into still involves plenty of moving and breathing. Today's guest is Jamie Abrahams, who I met about 5 years ago on a MoveNet course. She is a yoga teacher, a MoveNet instructor, an embodied yoga teacher, plus many, many other things. But these days she helps people with intimacy, sex, desire, finding a kind of health and wellness in an area which certainly us stiff upper lip Brits don't talk about too much. So I hope you enjoy it. I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thought I would giggle and be a school child much more than I actually was. I managed to hold it together pretty well and be relatively serious. So I hope that it's something you'll enjoy. I don't think we swear too much in it, but just be warned, obviously, we are discussing sex. If you're around kids, whether or not you want them to listen, there's nothing obviously pornographic, but we it's a subject that maybe you just want to be aware of, and I don't think there's too much swearing, so I'm trying to rein that back, as I say. So have a great week all. Christmas is just around the corner. Hope you all have a great Christmas. There'll be a new episode at the beginning of January, and I look forward to catching up with you soon. If you have any questions from anything that comes up in this episode, then feel free to drop me a line. And Jamie, the link to her pages is in the show notes, so you can find her and drop us a line, and maybe we can do a little Q&A sometime to go over some of the most common questions. Anyway, I'll let you crack on and enjoy the episode, and I'll see you all very soon. Wonderful. Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Move, Breathe, Live. A slightly different episode today. I apologize. I might giggle a lot and be a sort of 15-year-old boy for a lot of this, but we'll see. Today, I am chatting to my good friend, Jamie, who I have known for maybe 4 years now, I reckon.
Longer, probably.
Oh, yeah, probably longer. Maybe, I think it's actually, yeah. 2017, I think I did that MoveNet course. So, so I met Jamie, and I'm going to let her introduce herself and what she does, and then we will get into the nitty gritty and the all that stuff. So, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure.
So you'd like me to introduce myself, as because you felt you might blush if you had to.
Well, I think it's always better if somebody else introduced themselves, because I'll do it badly.
Okay. Well, I've been in the sort of well-being sphere for the last 23 years or so. And I've specialized in movement and yoga and embodiment. And over the last probably 6-7 years, I've really honed and specialized in sexuality, relationships, and intimacy. And I combine a lot of the embodiment practices to go with the relational aspect. And so basically, I help people get more connected sexually and intimately and relationally.
Perfect. Which now, guys, you can see why I'm going to giggle a lot, because we're going to talk about sex. And I'm basically a massive man child. But I think what you mentioned there is kind of important. So, Jamie very kindly at one point, pre-COVID, so maybe 2019, came down to Suffolk, and she ran an embodiment course. And as you just said, you kind of, you've had this whole embodied, I mean, it was an embodied yoga type practice, I guess, at some point, but it really it's just all about embodying yourself within that training, just again coming back to me being a massive man child and giggling a lot. Very quickly within that course, Jamie pointed out the fact that I hide behind humor for basically all of my insecurities and awkwardnesses. I just make jokes out of everything. So hence the fact today is going to be very much me making jokes and feeling uncomfortable. But there we go. So let's start with this then, because I think for me it was a real eye-opening experience, the embodied side of things, because it really did strip away, especially as a yoga, you know, it was like an embodied yoga practice. But as someone who maybe has, you know, I've been teaching yoga for 8 years, been practicing for 15, and then suddenly going into like an embodied yoga practice, very different and very stripping, I guess, and I want to say very bearing, sort of as in like, you know, naked bearing type thing. We didn't get naked in the course though, guys, just to clarify that.
Just to be clear. Yeah, so it's at the core of it, we're all animals, and our bodies reveal things to us and those around us more quickly than the headspace. And it's interesting because many people assume that yoga isn't, all yoga is embodied, and that's not the truth. Just because you're doing something with your body doesn't mean it's embodied. Or maybe I have a different definition of embodied or what it is to be embodied. And so for me, embodiment is everything is in congruence. So my mind, my emotions, my heart, and to be really fluffy about it, my yoni or my vulva space, and for maybe penis owners, is their penis, whatever. All of that is in alignment. And it's showing through how I am showing up. So when I'm showing up with you, that's all in congruence, because we've all met people and we've felt there's something not quite right about them. And it's because they're not in, there's something not in congruence. Either the words they're speaking don't match how they're actually physically showing up. And our brains tell us that in like a split second.
Yeah.
That's just how we were wired biologically to survive.
Nice. And yeah, I think it, like, as I say, kind of that within that group, I think, was I the only man in that group? I think I was. It's fairly standard for me to be the only man in just about everything I do. But it was, you know, like I say, I think us men tend to have a much harder time actually bearing ourselves and like opening up. And, you know, it was very... a lot of the women found it really quite kind of revealing, and really, you know, there was quite a lot of tears and all sorts within that group, I remember. And as I say, I just kind of hid behind laughing at everything, because clearly I just didn't actually want to open up. how common do you find like that? Because I guess this will lead into relationship talk in a little while, but like as a... you know, within that embodied practice, when men do come along, I'm assuming for the most part, they kind of think it's probably a load of old shit, or they kind of, you know, that's kind of their immediate outward thing is just dismiss and avoid actually. Or maybe this is just in England. I don't know. Maybe it's just us stiff upper lip English people. But
well, it's interesting because, yeah, embodiment is different depending on where you are. Yeah, I've taught embodiment all over the world. And yeah, very different countries show up in different ways. But to answer your question, I think embodiment practices and the way in which I use them and present them is that our body is a compass. And so the head can lie all the time. Like if you think about how many thoughts you've had already today, how many of them were truthful and how many of them were lies?
Mm-hmm.
Most of them were probably made up, especially if you have a critical mind, which I'm very guilty of. So a lot of my thoughts in my head, I know aren't actually true. The body has an inability to lie. So when we start using embodied practices to begin to explore different themes, whether that's, confidence, whether that's how you show up in relationship, because you can use embodiment practices to see how you show up relationally. It doesn't lie, and it it's not me having to tell people anything. They feel it for themselves. They discover it for themselves. I just give a few good inquiry questions or things for them to think about as they're, or feel into as they're using these practices. And so if there's that openness and willingness, people get it themselves. Like I'm not telling people stuff. It's like, hey, isn't this interesting? How does that feel? How does that land? Well, that's curious.
And I think from a male perspective, though, that's kind of maybe what's scary, terrifying type thing. Do you know what I mean? Because actually, like, I can remember being, and we were doing, I can't remember what it would be called, but we were doing like some sort of really big open like thing. And, you know, within that posture, there was definitely tears from girls, I guess, being like that open and that kind of vulnerable and whatever else. And like, obviously I just immediately went, like, you know, something ridiculous. And again, like trying to avoid actually feeling inwards, I guess. Yeah, feeling. Feelings are overrated anyway. I don't know what we're all on about. Just tuck them down there, keep burying them, they'll be fine.
Yeah, see how that works out for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, if we want to get right down into the nitty-gritty of conditioning, men and women are conditioned differently. Boys and girls are conditioned differently. And I know that there's a lot in between boys and girls these days, but I'm just going to speak explicitly to boys.
Biology.
And girls and how children are raised. Girls are, well, actually I'll start with boys because it's easier. Boys are obviously raised in such a way that their outward action is what gets praised. Oh, look at Tommy. Look how he can hit that ball, or look how hard he can kick. Da, 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 da. It's all about what Tommy is doing on the outside. Now for Jane, it's all about, oh, well, doesn't that dress look pretty? Isn't she such a sweet girl? Mm-hmm. She's so very kind. And so the girl's conditioning is all about how she's being. The boys is all about how he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that goes straight out into, you know, the ripple effect of then how we show up and how our internal dialogues are and what's acceptable, what's not acceptable, where the focus is. And a lot of my relationship and intimacy coaching with women comes down to all of the good girl conditioning. For them, it's the good girl conditioning and
trying to unwind that a little bit and let it be less so of that. That we mean?
It's understanding how that is playing out in their dynamics. So if you're good girl conditioning, you might not speak out about what you truly want in bed. You just mm-hmm. accept what's being offered.
Mm-hmm.
You might not understand your orgasm because you don't have any expectations around orgasm. And I don't mean expectations like every time we, you know, have a sexual experience, we should expect something. And then on that flip side, there is also space in the relationship dynamic that you also have pleasure and are pleased and can and have orgasm as well. So for, yeah, a lot of the women, it's this good girl conditioning. And then for the men, it's the, they're all about this, what's happening outside of themselves and not having that same ability to go inward. So it's really interesting work. And I also just want to give voice to good girl conditioning and how we're brought up is not, you know, something that I've discovered myself. I mean, yes, I've seen it. And if you want a really great resource on that, I would definitely recommend looking at Kasia Urbaniak's work. She's the one who I take a lot of inspiration from.
Cool. Around. Maybe you can send me that name afterwards because I'm definitely not going to be able to spell that quickly here. And I'll put it in the show notes. So if anyone wants to have a look at that, then absolutely they can. Cool. So, I mean, we've kind of, you know, done the embodiment stuff. We'll get straight into this kind of the more, because I wanted to chat to you really about the relational ships. I don't think that's a word, but the kind of, you know, the more kind of sex side of things and that side, because it's just a bit different from anything else I've had on the podcast. And I think it's clearly, again, going back to the British stiff upper lip thing, it's not necessarily something we overly talk about, and I think is probably a big problem in a lot of relationships. I feel that's kind of a fairly common thing. It's kind of almost a bit of a standard sort of joke of, we've been married for like 20 years and, you know, you kind of maybe get sex on your birthday or something like that. But like, you know, not so much just about the sex, but actually how it ties into the relationship and like the intimacy and like the ideas of desire and whatever else around it. And so there was a TED talk I saw a while after I was looking for you after we did this, and I was kind of trying to do some kind of research and, you know, not just come up with kind of dick and fart jokes and whatever else. But there was, I think her name was Karen Gurney or something like that. And she did a podcast, she did a TED talk about like the idea of desire and how, well, kind of what it came down to, it seemed to me, was that she was talking about like one of her couples that she obviously works with. And the idea of desire wasn't there in their relationship. Do you know what I mean? When your relationship first starts, you just want to rip each other's clothes off all the time and whatever else. And as it goes on, that kind of vanishes, for want of a better word. And then when you actually get to having sex, you're like, this is fucking brilliant. Why don't we do this all the time? And then obviously then you stop and then it kind of seems to vanish again. Then you kind of wait for another birthday to come around or something like that. But just how much that then plays into, I don't know, a man's and a woman's perspective on the relationship and what maybe, again, those ideas of expectations, I guess. Yeah. Does that make sense?
So, I mean, just to give voice to this, in the UK, 1 in 4 marriages are sexless. 1 in 4. So if you're at a party, 1 in 4 of your friends aren't having sex.
What's classed as not having sex?
I think having sex once or twice in a calendar year or
something. Right, okay.
Something like that. So by sex, I mean, that could be none, or it could be like less than, I think two to four times. It's something to that degree. So, you know, if you're thinking birthdays and
Christmas,
holidays, there you go. You're in a sexless marriage. That's classified as a sexless marriage. So yeah, it is really, really common. And unfortunately so, because our sexuality is this really beautiful, nourishing resource if we allow it to be,
mm-hmm.
if we give presence to it. So you asked a lot in there, and I'm going to just see where to begin. Let's start with desire. So there are two kinds of desire. There's spontaneous desire, mm-hmm. and there's responsive desire. And spontaneous desire is exactly what it says on the tin. Like, oh, all of a sudden I feel I want to have sex. So I'm going to make that happen, whether that's through masturbation or going to my partner and seeing if we can have sex. It's like, yeah. It just comes to you and you want it. Where responsive desire is, it's like warming up to the idea. You don't just see a naked picture and think, oh man, I want to have sex. There's like a lot more to lean into to begin warming up the juices.
Yeah.
So when we first get into relationship, we are high in that spontaneous desire, because yeah. It's like just the glance, the look at the shoulder of your boyfriend, or, you know, a little bit of cleavage on your girlfriend, whatever it is,
yeah.
is enough. Like, well, I need to get those knickers off. Where that changes, and that's normal, by the way. This is completely, completely normal that in early relationships, like the honeymoon phase, that there's a lot of this spontaneous desire.
Yeah.
And as relationships mature, you get more into this responsive desire. And that's because our partners are no longer novel to us. Mm-hmm. They are no longer mysterious to us. There are no longer obstacles. And it's that, what's called a passion trifecta, which involves all three of those elements, that there's mystery,
mm-hmm.
obstacles, and that there's novelty. Now, if you understand those three guiding principles in the passion trifecta, you can begin bringing them back into your relationship, and you can mm-hmm. begin actively working on it. But I think what happens is that because popular culture and movies and songs, they kind of train us to think that spontaneous desire is the only kind of desire. And if you're not having that, then there's probably something wrong with you or your relationship. And then it's also the, it becomes like this vicious cycle of like, oh, but I don't just want to have sex. And so, oh, therefore there must be something wrong with me or my partner. And then there's not the motivation to kind of do something about it because they people don't realize that actually in a long-term relationship, just like with any relationship, you have to put a bit of work into it. And so, yeah.
So with that then, just like that little trifecta that you're talking about, to me, like you say, like novelty is, you know, probably the biggest thing that not in just in sex, but like as a race, like we're constantly after novelty. Do you know what I mean? It's like we seem to crave it, whether it be an iPhone, the newest iPhone, whether it be fucking anything. It's just, but like, and again, I keep going back to like, I'm sure it's not just in England and Great Britain and, you know, the stiff upper lip bar, but like what you've just said there, like until I mean, I've obviously been following you for a little while. And so maybe I've read, you know, I've read your post, whatever, but I still know nothing about this really until we said, let's do this chat. And I started looking up a few bits like, I know those, what you said, spontaneous and what was the other one?
Responsive.
Responsive. So I'd never heard of those. And like it suddenly makes, it does make perfect sense, but we as a culture have no idea about this at all. And so the idea of trying to put those three things back in to a relationship, like you kind of feel, it feels like, and I've definitely been in relationships where, you know, I had a long-term relationship previously and like 3 of the 6-ish years were totally sexless. And yet, you know, and it got to the stage, it's like, well, we're basically just, you know, it
Roommate.
just felt like we're just basically roommates who, like, I don't know, just see each other shower. Do you know what I mean? That's kind of essentially what it is. And so then it gets to the stage where in your brain, you're just like, well, this isn't actually a relationship. You know, it's just, it's like me living with my best mate who I've been in a band with for 10 years or something. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of, I mean, I don't see him shower, let's put it that way. But yeah, it's kind of one of those things of, so actually I guess my biggest thing coming into this is like, it feels to me, certainly as a man, I'm gonna put it across as my male perspective, is that actually like sex is a kind of relatively imperative part of a successful long-term relationship. I don't know, is that like a fair assumption?
I mean, I'm a bit biased because I'm a sex and intimacy coach. So my bias is yes. Like we are what well, okay. So yes, it's my bias. And yes, I also think that's the case because we are also wired biologically for connection. That is our biological wiring. And you know, connection can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And yes, as we age and hormones change, maybe your relationship to sex and sexuality or what that looks like changes, and there's still a need for that contact. There's still a need for that coming together, so to speak. I did that one just for you, Wibbs.
Yeah, thank you.
You're
Thank you.
welcome. Oh.
Yeah, because it feels to me that, you know, that idea of, as you said, that coming together, that intimacy, that connection, let's say connection rather than intimacy, but that connection you get during slash post sex, you know, if you have not been having sex for a while and you do, it's like I kind of, like I said in that podcast, it's kind of like when you do end up having sex, it's like, fuck, this is brilliant. Why don't we do this all the time? And you know, you suddenly do have a far greater connection with the person that you're with.
Well, I mean, there's a few things to this. So when we're first early in relationship, we'll call it the honeymoon phase. Our body is releasing like hormonal cocktails. We are high on our hormones for this other person. And so we get a lot of that. And then as we edge towards being in a longer term relationship, our body no longer releases those same chemicals. And so that's where novelty comes in. Our brain needs the novelty to begin releasing those hormones. So yes, when you're in a sexually intimate situation with your partner, you are releasing all the feel good hormones. So you're getting that. And you think, yeah, why didn't we do this? So there's also been research around couples that talk about their sex and their sex life have more sex. If you're not talking about your sex life, you're probably not having as much sex. And you said something else I was going to comment on. What was that? The release of hormones. Yeah, so it goes straight back into this passion trifecta of needing the novelty. So I think novelty is pretty self-explanatory to people. Novelty could mean having sex somewhere you wouldn't normally have it. Novelty could be wearing something different. Novelty could be trying something different, like trying shibari, which is the like Japanese rope tying, or you know, novelty could just be having sex in a different position. So novelty can mean something different for each person. Obstacle is, so if you think about when you were a teenager and maybe you weren't meant to be I don't know, kissing and snogging and groping and feeling, and it was all sort of done really quickly in the car, or you know, there was always like the risk of being caught. That's obstacle. So how do you build obstacle in? Obstacle could mean designing an adventure date with your partner where they aren't allowed to speak. They're not allowed to maybe touch you through the whole dinner meal, or you know, there's some obstacle. An obstacle can come in many different ways, but you make it a challenge to kind of be with the person. And obviously, mystery is in longer term relationships, we assume we know all there is to know about our partners. And curiosity goes out the window. And I often tell people, or I say to people, that curiosity is like one of the biggest, for me, pieces in a relationship. How do you remain curious about your partner? Like, don't know everything there is to know. They're constantly changing and evolving. And I, you know, I'm not the same person I was when I first met my partner. So it's, how do we build curiosity and mystery? So mystery in this context, like an adventure date, so to speak, could mean telling them that they need to wear gym shoes and not to wear high heels, but they don't know what that means. They don't know what's coming. They don't know what's going to happen. So it's like, how do you build some mystery into what you're already doing?
Nice.
Yes.
And I guess that, so I mean, this is then the idea of, if you are in that sexless relationship, let's say, how, it's, I guess it's so hard, it can be really hard to get started, can't it? Because refinding that connection in that kind of through that intimacy and that connection stuff, you, as you said, you probably need to start trying to find novelty and, mystery and all of that. That's that, that's probably the what you need to do. But, I guess starting off, if you've ended up going through that spontaneous desire at the beginning of the relationship and you never really talk about it, you just get your rocks off essentially. And then you end up, a few years down the line, and it's all of a sudden, it's you don't have that spontaneous, and then actually you've got to start talking. It's kind of suddenly more of a challenge to refine that intimacy.
Yeah, so there's it's sort of sex kind of just sort of goes out the window slowly usually, and a lot of couples don't notice it until it's like it's usually when sex goes out the window, it's a symptom of something else happening in the relationship. So people will come to me, or couples will come to me, and they think that not having sex is the problem or the issue or the challenge, when actually there's a lot of other deeper things happening, and that sex is just one of the symptoms. So that's interesting as well. Like looking at what's actually happening and where is the breakdown and the disconnect come from. And But there has to be a point when one or both people are going to name the elephant in the room, which is, we're not having sex anymore. And I'm really sad about that, or I'm angry about that, or I really miss you, or whatever the feeling is about not having that connection with your partner. And usually it's sadness and despair and hopelessness, because as sort of partnerships are designed by default, most partnerships are monogamous, and most partner people go into the relationship think, you know, feeling, well, this is the one thing that I share with you, and I'm not allowed to share it with anyone else. And now we're not even doing that. Like, we don't even have that anymore. So there is a real big sense of hopelessness, especially in, you know, monogamous relationships. And that's hard. It's a big hurdle.
Definitely. And I think that kind of leads into a little bit with one of the posts I saw on your Instagram page, which obviously I'll put up in the show notes so people can find you. But I think it was like not the last one, maybe two before, but the idea of kind of within that monogamous relationship is then like the idea of attraction to others whilst you're in a relationship, which I thought was quite a an interesting read, because I, you know, it's almost it feels that sort of thing is like a forbidden idea, it feels like.
Yeah, so I think I'm not a very popular person for for that sentiment, which is, so what I was saying is, let's normalize attraction. Let's normalize attraction to other human beings, and it doesn't matter what form they come in, what package they come in. We are attracted. Like, when you are out and about walking around, your eyes will naturally, like, oh wow, isn't she stunning? Or he's a good looking guy. And that's okay. That doesn't have to mean anything. And so for me, it's first normalizing it, that that's okay and normal. And that doesn't mean anything else. That doesn't mean I don't love my partner. It doesn't mean I don't find my partner hot, et cetera. But then there's also using that as a way to build more attraction. So for example, my partner and I, we use this to build more attraction between the two of us. Or to enter into a fantasy that we know we're never going to act on, but it's kind of fun to talk about, and it makes us feel hotter for each other. So, for example, if we're out and about, because I hate to say this, there are always more hot women than there are hot men. Sorry, guys, but it's just, I don't
Does this
mean to be
moustache
rude.
help? Does this moustache make me hot?
So, Wibbs has a big porno stash, which, you know, I think is great.
It's not a porno stash. It's my Australian chopper. I was trying to be like fucking chopper.
No, it's definitely porno stash, and I think it's working, mate. I think it's working.
Jen does not, by the way. She's not a fan.
Then you might need to look at that if you want to work on the attraction and desire there. So yeah, so with my partner and I, if we're out and about and there's a woman, because I am secure enough to realize that there are a lot of hot women out there, and I'm never going to be the most beautiful woman in the room. It's not going to happen. And that doesn't mean I don't think I'm attractive. It's just the reality of it. There are a lot of beautiful women. So anyway, we're out and about, and there's a woman who's wearing like really high boots and a short skirt, and she looks great in it. And so then it's sort of like he'll say to me, or I'll say to him, "Ooh, would you like me to wear a pair of boots like that?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, of course. Damn right I would." And then it can turn into something about either me having something that she has, or how would you chat her up? And then it turns into this game of how he might chat her up, or if I think she's hot enough for him, because like I have high standards, and like he'll be like, "Oh, she's hot." I'm like, "No, she's not hot enough for you." And so we make it into like a fun play thing. And it's like at the end of the day, I know he really loves me and he finds me hot, and I really love him and he, you know, I find him hot. So it's, how can we normalize these things that our brains are thinking
We're just
anyway,
not talking about. I
just not
mean,
talking about?
your point there, like when you said, oh, you know, we play like a game and maybe I say, you know, how might you chat her up? That would go horrendously for
Mm-hmm.
me. I would be fucking terrible at that. Or love.
I mean, it's not that he actually ever would, but it's sort of like
No.
he would say to me, "Oh, maybe I would sing her a song. I'm like, no, you can't sing a woman like that a song. You'd have to. And then we like make a game up about what he could do that might woo her. And it's more like playing on the things that we find a little bit silly about ourselves, because,
We are
he
ridiculous.
has this certain stance or this walk that he does when he's joking around. I'm like, oh, are you gonna go and do that to her? Is that gonna, get her to drop her knickers or whatever? And so it just becomes like this silly thing.
That's like I say, I found like when I read that, it was kind of like an interesting one. I think, as you said, it's kind of potentially some people might find it an unpopular view or something. But as I found it like on the first read, it's a bit like, that sounds a bit like, and then you read it a few more times. And as you say, it's the sort of thing which does go through the head. And I think it's just, I guess it comes down to insecurities and or securities of being able to be like, she was fucking smoking, or and not having the other person go, all right, well, she looks nothing like me, so what the fuck are you saying?
And also, I mean, there's also putting some boundaries on and around this. So, you have to start with because it's so opposite to what we are culturally shown that's allowed. You have to kind of get your nervous system on board. And so maybe it's at first starting with celebrities, because a celebrity feels untouchable anyway, right? And so you have to start small and build towards it. And then also there's a piece around boundary. So if I'm in sweatpants and feeling disgusting and gross and my hair is up, hasn't been
Tied
washed
up,
in days, like the last thing I want to, oh, and I'm on my period, the last thing I want to hear is how hot this other woman is. And so it's up to me in that moment to say, you know what, babe, no, I don't want to hear about it. And you know what? He doesn't, but and he knows that it's okay, and that'll be okay at another time. So it's up to the two of you to put boundaries in, or to say, when you know what,
Not in the list today.
I'm not into, I've had a shit day, I don't want to hear about that hot guy or hot girl or whatever. And then it's like, okay, well, that's fine too.
For sure. As far as I guess, I think because of everything we've gone through over the last few years, and I guess coming back to the sexless relationships and stuff, but I'm probably going to pronounce it wrong. Is it the Natsal COVID study or something?
Yeah, the Natsal COVID study.
Can you go into that a little bit? Because it's interesting that we were, and again, I guess there's a lot of people who during COVID ended up being locked in their house with their partners, but potentially also with kids and whatever else. And I think we knew, I think we're all fully aware just how bad lockdowns were for just about everyone's like mental health and physical for a certain degree. I think there were some people who got pretty active, but many didn't. But like, I think if I say sexual health, that probably sounds wrong. Sexual,
Well-being.
yeah, their sexual well-being, let's put it that way. It had a pretty big knock-on effect for that as well.
Yeah, so I haven't looked at the Natsal report in a while. I've looked at it in the past. And basically it's pretty dire. It's pretty dire, the impact that COVID had on relationships. And I mean, there were all sorts of, I don't think this was in Natsal, by the way, this stat that I'm gonna share, because it's somewhere else that I shared it. But over COVID, at one point there was some research or paper saying that women said that the worst sex that they'd ever experienced was with their current partner in relationships. And so there's not only sex isn't happening because we've been closed up with people, and there's no space for the fire to breathe. I mean, there's
That's a nice way of
no
putting it.
space for that fire to breathe. And also, being kind of locked in, so to speak, there's nowhere to hide, and you kind of see all the annoying bits of the other person without any of the nice fluffy stuff, the nice, juicy, sweet stuff. There is that. So not only were people not having connection and intimacy when they probably really, at a time when people really
Needed it.
desperately needed it, the actual sexual intimacy they were having was really bad. It was really poor. Like, people weren't satisfied. Like, no one would, like, people were more women than men, and that has to do with the orgasm gap as well.
It's definitely easier for us men.
It's easier. It's like way easier. And going straight back to this good girl conditioning, women haven't been taught like what pleasure is. You know, there's some other ridiculous stat, like a really high stat. I don't know what it is off the top of my head, but like women couldn't even locate and name their genitalia. Like, where is the clit? What is the vulva? Like, still people don't know the difference between vulva and vagina.
Yeah.
Like, and those, and they have it on their body, and they don't know the difference between vulva and vagina. And so anyway, for anyone listening who doesn't know, like, I'm not shaming you in any way. It has more to do with how we're educated and what's taught to us. And so, by the way, vulva is all of the exterior, vagina is the actual inside.
But so again, sort of, I mean, maybe I'm jumping around a little bit, but I find this, so like Jen and I were chatting about it a while back, but we were chatting also about like menstrual cycles, I know, and like just how poor any kind of talk education for women, like, it's fuck men, like, they, I mean, they don't want to know anyway, let's face it, but but even for women, just how poor the understanding is of the different cycles, and how, you know, your moods, feelings, like drive, want to exercise, to do anything, is going to change throughout that, let's say, 4 week period. And actually how having a better understanding can probably allow you to understand when you do feel good and bad and want and don't want, and you know how, you know, the luteal phase is going to drive different hormones to, you know, any other phase. You know, it's kind of like that to me, especially is what, you know, all my breath work and stuff I do, kind of understanding how progesterone changes throughout the cycle and how that changes your stress response and how heavy you breathe and how much more CO2 you'll end up blowing off. So how stressed you'll feel. Like, to me, that just seems like that should be information that women should have as a, like, at a crazy young age, like as soon as it starts, really, like as you're leading into. But from my perspective as a man, like, understanding, say, where Jen is in her cycle allows me to feel way more, I'd like to think, she might disagree, more compassionate to like the state that she is finding herself in. And by states, I don't mean, God, she's a right old fucking state, but I mean like the, you know, the psychological states that she's in of when she's really struggling with like the shit at work. But, you know, you can near enough map it out to when like progesterone is starting to spike and when, I don't know. And that, to me, it's, again, it all just seems to tie in with probably this stiff upper lip British idea of like, shh, we'll just take this tampon and just go in there and just be all right.
Sort yourself out, sort yourself out. Yeah, I mean, our reproductive health, our sexual health, they're unfortunately, and it's not just here in the UK, you know, it's in the US as well. It's not taught. It's not, we're not taught about our bodies biologically. Like, we're kind of only taught like abstinence, like don't have sex.
Yeah.
Or you know, here's a condom. Like, it's sort of that's about it. Or here, if you have sex, you're gonna get STIs. So that's kind of the basis of how most people understand their bodies. And it's sad. It's a really sad state of affairs when we get into the lack of education around sexual health, sexual well-being, and that goes right down into women's and girls' menstrual cycles. 100%. I totally agree with you. And, you know, if we want to look to see who's doing it right, we need to look at some of our Norwegian, Scandinavian.
Always the Scandinavian.
You know, like, how they're getting it right, you know, like go to Holland and see how they're getting it right. You know, the kids are learning about this stuff from very young, but in a very age appropriate way.
Yeah, I think that's the thing as
Definitely.
well, isn't it? I think there's definitely there all at times there's a thing of like can't teach kids that, you know, and it, but it's like, again, I mean, you could, I don't know, there's a lot of stuff.
I saw this video. I don't know how I got onto this video yesterday. I don't know. Some junk came to me, and anyway, it was basically this mom telling her twin daughters, like they were little, like maybe 2 or 3 years old, I'm guessing, that she was pregnant and they were going to have a brother or a sister. And the little girls said to their mother, "Well, how did you get a baby?" And she couldn't. She just said, "Your daddy and I, what? How did she say?" We got together. It was something so vague, and I thought, wow, what a moment, what a teaching moment that could have been for those two little girls, as opposed to thinking, oh, they're too young to understand about sex. I mean, it doesn't have to be like super explicit, like mommy dressed up in some lingerie and then daddy got his rocks, you know, whatever it is. It doesn't have to be that. It can be something so sweet and neutral and loving. And anyway, and I just, yeah, so yeah, that just makes me think of that. I'm like, oh, what, you know, and that, so not even, not only are children not getting it at school, they're not getting it at home.
No.
And, you know, my partner started a school in Italy, an alternative education school. And he was talking to me about this idea around bringing in sex education at a younger age. Like, what were my thoughts on that? What were my feelings on it? And it was sort of like, yeah, you can bring it in at school, but you need to start, like, it's like you also need to bring the parents in. It's like the parents who need to be re-educated and talked to about this stuff to make this stuff have a real impact. Like it's the adults, because if there's a lot of sexual shame and you can't even say the word penis, you know, or vagina or vulva, you can't even like actually say those words. That's kind of, you know, that's not setting
Bad
our
foot to
future
set
up.
off. And I guess that probably leads into the idea of like more and more these days that like porn is probably like being left to educate, which is obviously just the most terrible idea.
Yeah, I mean, I read this really scary study research paper about porn and what it is doing and how it is rewiring the brains of our young people, and then how that then affects the girls and the women that who aren't necessarily watching porn but are getting it via, you know, their sexual partners. And it's frightening. It's really, really frightening. And you know, I have a teenage son, and I have a daughter who is sort of a tween, and I am so scared for my daughter. I'm really like scared for what her sexual future might look like. I really am.
It's not like it's kind of the 70s with like just, you know, dodgy VHS and like, you know, just a couple of people having sex. It's kind of, yeah, it's all pretty
It's
crazy.
become it's the novelty. It's become more and more and more and more extreme, to the point that, you know, the brain becomes wired for, well, already the brain is wired for novelty, which is why porn is so effective, especially in the male brain, because, you know, they it's there's a great TED talk on actually the porn in the brain, and I'll give you the link for that for sure. Like, but how, you know, that the male brain is wired for that novelty, and porn feeds directly into that by showing, you know, you can have as many women as you want in 30 seconds. You know what I mean? You can have as many women, and your brain doesn't know the difference, and so then it craves it, and but it needs something even more novel, even more novel, even more, which is where all this extreme kind of
Weird shit comes in.
porn is coming out, and it's
But I guess
horrible.
it's there's also, I guess, with the male to female thing, it's like men have a, I seem like as a man, like have a different like perspective on it. Do you know what I mean? It's very much like a visual thing for a man, whereas like for a woman, it seems from my experience, it's much less about the visual and more about that kind of, and maybe it comes back to exactly what we started with, like with the doing and being type thing. Do you know what I mean? Like men do and like want to, and whereas women be, and it's probably a
Well,
similar.
I think there's definitely a piece around our conditioning. So we haven't actually spoken at all about the erotic blueprints, which is something that I specialize in and work with when it comes to sexuality. And so I can speak about that in a second if you wish. But there's also how we are wired erotically, and more men think that they're wired towards one particular blueprint, and that would make porn quite appealing for that blueprint. So it's also how are we wired erotically. And so that's not to say some women might actually really quite get off on porn, but not the same kind of porn that men get off on. Yeah, so there's also our erotic wiring as well.
That makes sense. Maybe just, I mean, we're chomping through time. We've got another 10 minutes or so, but maybe just briefly you can go into those kind of like the blueprints a little bit, and like, because I think, you know, from my perspective, why, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you, and I think what I wanted to kind of look at really was just the ideas of like, it seems to me like, you know, this whole podcast is called Move, Breathe, Live, and I want it to be about people like, yes, like moving and breathing to live a happier, healthier life, but like the living the life is also, I mean, let's face it, you have to move and breathe a fair amount, hopefully a fair amount during sex, but like the relational side of it, like it's, we're such it's, it seems to me, it just seems such an important part of like actually living a contented, like full life of, you know, let's face it, if you're single, everyone just wants to have a partner, and like if you've got a partner, like you want to be able to keep that partner, and actually sex is just like such a big part of that, and the, not necessarily just the act of sex, but everything around it, like the intimacy, the desire, the connection of it all. You know, that's basically what, from I do, you know, I mean, I remember being at school and being like tiny, and like, you know, you kind of holding hands with a girl, and you know, it's kind of that connection. You know, you're too young to understand any of it, but you understand that connection of like that to another person.
Yeah, and so I agree with
Hey.
you. Sexual intimacy definitely has to involve a bit of movement and breathing, hopefully. And sexual intimacy and relationship are often the things that are sort of left off the menu under the well in the well-being sphere. Like I was invited to be a part of this conference at one point. And I looked at what was already being offered, and I'm like, can I offer something around sexuality, relationship, intimacy? Because that's clearly not being shown here. And they didn't allow it. They didn't allow it. And I just thought, oh, well, I mean, and then I didn't end up being a part of it. But it was, and then I was called out for even suggesting that, for even suggesting that there should ha that that should be on the menu available. And I just thought, how can that not be? Like, you're representing everything else. Why would this be left off? So yeah, it's in the shadows. It's in the shadows. And if it stays in the shadows, it's going to continue to create shame. We're going to continue to have generations addicted to porn. By the way, I'm not against porn. I'm not like totally against porn, but it's the way in which porn is being made and consumed that I am not an
But
advocate for.
also, like on that list of things you're ticking off, but like, I mean, I've not looked at any statistics or whatever, but I would assume currently the rates of like divorce and stuff are probably more so than they maybe have been in the past. Maybe that's just partly because in the past, like it was tough shit, you didn't get divorced. But like, do you, I mean, I don't know, like the connection you get through the intimacy, the desire, the kind of the sexual well-being is such an important part of like building a relationship to begin with, and like when that disappears, like it could, it can be pretty sick, you know, certainly from, like I say, my past relationship, it kind of got to the stage you're like, why are we even fucking, I
Doing
don't
this.
know.
Yeah, and it's the that glue, that sexual intimacy, that glue that holds a relationship. When that disappears, it's, I don't know, I've been in a sexless marriage, and So speaking from my experience and of those of many others that I've also met who've been in the relationships, it's sort of you become less forgiving. It's like when your partner does something that's annoying, when you're sexually connected, like you can let that stuff wash away so much more easily. All that annoying shit, because we're all annoying. We all have our annoying bits. Like it's fact. We are all annoying people. But we can let a lot of that stuff go when there's goodwill and there's intimacy and there's that fire and desire to be with the other. And it's also normal for this stuff to go into waves, but it's sort of like, what's the baseline for that? What's the baseline for that connection?
I think, as you said there, like, because you brought it up, I don't know, when we chat, and I can't remember when it was, but you know, but like the fact is, like, it is completely normal to have like dry spells, to have like dry, you know, patches when you're not having sex. But you know, having the ability, I guess, having the ability to like talk and like actually go through these things, and then, as you say, if need be, kind of try to bring in those novelty factors or whatever it is to
Yeah, I mean dry spells are they are normal. It's like a natural fluctuation in our sexuality. But I guess around those dry spells, are they is it being talked about or is it being shoved under to then not be talked about? You know, you can have a dry spell because one or more partners could be in poor health, and it doesn't mean that there's still not there could still be intimacy and connection, and it's also named. It's like, oh, you know, I know we can't have sex because you've been unwell or you're on this medication, and I really miss it, and I really miss you, and we'll still connect in these other ways until that time when we can be sexual the way we wish to be. So it's sort of like, are the dry spells being named and addressed, or is it just something else that's being put under the
Put under
carpet?
the carpet. Yeah. Well, we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left. But so what I will finish with then, and hopefully you can kind of go into some. So I forgot to tell you about this beforehand because I fucking always forget. But the podcast is called Move, Breathe, Live. And I mean, I think you've kind of gone over some, you know, some good ideas throughout the podcast anyway that people can probably take away. But I ask people who come on to see if they can offer a little bit of sage advice that maybe they can take away from this, that maybe they can try to implement into their daily life, into their, you know, I don't know, into their relationship in this case, or whatever else it would be. So normally, obviously, I have people who are movement, breathing type people. Obviously, not that you're not, because that's, let's face it, that's how we met, crawling around in the fucking Hampstead Heath or something. But have you got anything that people who are listening can perhaps try to take away, try to put into their life to maybe, I don't know, improve their sexual well-being, whether solo or together or whatever else it might be?
Yeah, I mean, I have many things
I've got
that
all of the things. I've got all of them.
I have all the things, and I'm just trying to think what might be like an easy win, because that's what's always nice is to have an easy win. And so I think the easy win I'll share with you is this one. It's to start to begin to understand your own desire and your own pleasure. An easy win would be to every time you put the kettle on to boil, or every time you pick up your phone to check Instagram, or if there's something that you do repeatedly during the day, I'm going to invite you to toggle this to that. Okay. So every time before you put the kettle, if you put the kettle on, stop for that 30 seconds. If you can, close your eyes. If it doesn't look weird, close your eyes. And do a body scan. Scan your body from head to toe, toe to head, whatever way you want, and see if there's something that already feels at ease or pleasurable in your body. Okay? So that could be, oh, my belly actually feels really relaxed right now. My shoulders feel really soft. Now, if that feels completely and totally foreign, you can go with something that's outside of your body. So it could be, you know what? If you're sitting, I'm really feeling appreciative of how this chair is supporting me right now. I like the way my feet feel on the ground. I like the way my hair, or it feels pleasurable the way my hair is moving across my face. I
Yeah.
like how my clothes are on my body. It could be something as simple as that, but to begin anchoring yourself to what is already pleasurable in the body. And by doing this, you're getting your nervous system on board. You're getting your nervous system on board, and you're also stopping and giving yourself a moment to have a bit of pleasure, which then you can then roll out into other places. So if you're never in a place of knowing what feels pleasurable in the body, it's a really hard place to start.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. As you say, like the idea of bringing the nervous system on board, because I mean, I think any of us who have ever done any work that like that we do, like you realize just if you chuck, I mean, if you chuck too much novelty at the nervous system too quickly, it shits the bed and go, oh my God.
It's always calibration. I work a lot explicitly with the nervous system, because if I'm working with a couple or an individual, their nervous system has to be on board.
Yeah.
Because if the nervous system isn't on board with whatever, and sex can be a really highly charged thing, and the nervous system can go out the window, and you can go and fight, flight, freeze, phone, whatever F you want. It has to be done in a nervous system friendly way. And
Yeah.
so begin gently by first noticing what's already pleasurable in the body, and that takes your body into rest and digest. That gets your body into parasympathetic nervous system straight away.
Amazing. Perfect. I love it. So where can people find you if they want to come and like divulge all the sexual desires? Not like that, obviously, just professionally.
Yeah, so I'll give you my website. You can go to my website, academyforintimacy.com, and on there I offer you can apply to work with me, and to do that you fill out a form. It lets me know a little bit more about you, see if we're a good working fit, and then I offer you a free discovery call, and we can decide
Cool.
if we want to take it any further. And of course I'm on all the
Internship.
Instagram and all that stuff, but I'll give you that for the show notes.
Yeah, that'd be perfect. Amazing. Thank you. I think I managed to hold it together pretty well without being a giggling child too much.
You didn't
Obviously,
at all, actually. You were actually brilliant. You
I
did really
mean, you know, I think if you were watching me, I mean, I'm pretty good, but I think body language wise, I definitely it was tight. I was kind of, you know, a bit like this, but I actually
well.
felt pretty comfortable in all fairness. But there you go. Thank you so much. I actually really, really enjoyed it. I think it was, I don't know. I actually think it's a probably an as I've said, I think it's in the wellness sphere, as you said, it's completely underlooked at and just completely forgotten. And I'm pretty happy that we got to talk about it and like bring it up.
Thank you so much, Ribs. I really appreciate you having me.
It's my pleasure. Everyone, go check out Jamie's bits and pieces. Not her bits and pieces, obviously, but her. I'll get in a few look. Her website and stuff. And yeah, I'll see you all next week for another great podcast. Have a good week, all.